everything or nothing, whichever you choose. I let out a gasp. But why would he write such a thing? Sappho and her father exchanged a great many letters over the years. Can you imagine? Living in the same house, but writing long letters back and forth. It was a queer relationship in every way. I could show you letters with passages even more explicit. But that one gives you a rather good sense of the man, I think, of his absurd self-justification. He actually believed that his daughter invited his attentions, wanted them, craved them. In his mind, it was she who seduced him, just as in that vile poem. King Cinyras was famously handsome, I said quietly, almost divinely so, irresistible, even to his own daughter, as Cinna believed himself to be. She saw me shake my head. Oh, yes. In some letters he even makes a play on the similarity of their names, Cinyras and Cinna, as if they were one and the same. Yet he named his daughter Sappho, not Smyrna. Yes, named her Sappho, and then mocked her poems. That's in the letters as well. We have some of her letters, but none of her poems, because she burned each one after it earned his scorn. Yet she kept writing new ones. How desperately she wanted to please that revolting man in any way she could. She would never have killed Cinna herself, I said. No, nor would any man ever have seen to his punishment. He broke no law. Within his own home, the supremacy of a father's will is beyond question. Other men might detest his behaviour, but no statute forbids it. So it fell to us, to the women, to do what had to be done, with the help of Father Liber. The poem was his fantasy, I whispered. If only the fantasy had been enough for him, he had to make it reality. At such a cost. Like Caesar, said Fulvia. What? How like Caesar? Cinna had a fantasy of rape and power. He made it real and ruined his daughter's life, and his own, in the end. Caesar, too, had fantasies of rape and power. The rape of whole cities, whole nations. The power to rule over every other man on earth, to the end of his days, and to do so seated on a golden throne. Well, he got his wish, didn't he? Would that such a fantasy had stayed in his imagination? Instead, he made it real at the cost of hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of deaths, not just those in combat, but all the multitudes of women and children who died from starvation and pestilence and the cruelties of enslavement. Caesar was the progenitor of countless crimes. And your Antony? How is he any different? Will he not follow Caesar's example, if he can? Does he too desire a golden throne? She flashed a bitter smile. Yes, all men are the same. But some are more useful than others. Cinna or Caesar, which man's fantasy would you have put a stop to, if you could? The question is unfair. Why not imagine a world in which men never have such fantasies? Yes, that might be a better world. Or better still, a world without people in it, without gods as well, or even animals, only stone and water and sunshine and air. A perfect world without suffering or cruelty or death. Unchanging, stretching on for all eternity. But we don't live in such a world, Fulvia. We live in a world that teems with life of every sort, with every man and beast in desperate competition with every other, sometimes even with the gods. So, we must simply put up with men like Caesar or my Antony, or try to harness them for our own uses. but we need not put up with men like Cinna. For a long moment, I was lost in thought. Fulvia, too, was silent. I cleared my throat. I know now who killed Cinna, and why. But not how, exactly, or what became of him. Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
She stepped away from me and slowly paced the room. We always planned to behead him, and to tear off certain parts of his anatomy, those parts which had offended all decency. The hands that wrote the words, the vile genitals that committed the outrage. As Maenads, we knew we could rely on the unwavering power of Dionysus to give us the necessary strength. To inspire us further, we burned myrrh to infuse our clothing with the scent. Myrrh, in honour not of any man or poem, but in memory of Smyrna, defiled by her father and the tears she shed. Let it be the last thing Cinna smelled, along with the stench of his own blood.
His blood, I whispered. The paving stones were soaked with it. Yet afterward, there was no flesh to be seen.
The blood was quite important for the purification ritual.
Ritual?
Thrice we suck a bit of the victim's blood into our mouths, and thrice we spit it out. Thus the act is made pleasing to Father Liber. But there is an even more ancient blood ritual, an act of expiation, almost never performed nowadays.
Yes, go on.
Because of the crowd all around us, the Maenads had to act almost in silence. No shrieks or shouts to work up our frenzy, for our feminine voices would give us away. Usually, her voice is the only way a woman is allowed to vent her emotions, either that or some violence against her own body, tearing her hair or rending her cheeks. We silenced our voices, and instead we took action. That enforced silence caused our frenzy to become all the more intense. So frenzied, so intense.
Yes, go on.
We touched the very face of the god that day, she whispered, staring into the distance. Thrice we were to lick the blood from his severed parts, and thrice to spit it out. Thus those organs could never again harm us, could never take revenge either in this world or the next. Even the Furies would be assuaged. His head, his hands, his genitals, severed and rendered powerless forever. But the Maenads became truly mad, all of us, all at once. We reached back into the deepest, darkest past. We enacted the blood ritual at its most primitive and most powerful. No man can ever hope to reach such a state of divine frenzy, only those of us who follow Father Liber.
What did you do to Cinna? What did you do to the parts of Cinna after you tore him to pieces?
I knew, but I had to hear it.
We ate him. I covered my mouth in horror.
We devoured his raw flesh, crushed him with our teeth and swallowed him.
She turned toward me.
On her face I saw not horror but a kind of ecstasy. It was the most perfect and most complete rite of Bacchus I have ever experienced, and I doubt that I will ever experience such a thing again, a rite worthy of our most ancient ancestors, of those mortals never to be forgotten who populate the ancient legends and myths. There was no limit to our power in that moment. It was blissful, exquisite, indescribably beautiful. It was beyond anything you can ever hope to experience, beyond anything you can imagine.
I shivered.
What about the bones?
You can't have eaten those. Only the marrow. The gorge rose in my throat. As for the rest of his bones, he said, by that time there were already bonfires around the forum, started by men telling the mob to light torches, hoping to burn down the houses of Brutus and the rest. When we were done, we threw the bones and other bits and pieces on the fires. They were burned to ashes, and no one took notice. And the head? The head was carried off as a trophy by a man I hired to do so, intentionally to distract the funeral-goers and lead them away so that we could carry on our business uninterrupted and unobserved. The man saw to it that the head was eventually tossed into the Tiber, food for fishes, the traditional end for a beheaded criminal. They say that a man who's lost his head in this world remains without it in Hades as well, body and head severed for all time, a fit punishment for sinner. But how could you have taken such a risk? Sinner had a bodyguard that day, as did I. What if Davis and the bodyguard hadn't been lost in the crowd? What if they had fought back? She smiled. It was Sinner's bodyguard who carried off his head. The man was in my pay, one of my spies in Sinner's household. First he abandoned his master at my signal, and saw to it that your son-in-law was separated from you and lost in the crowd. It was he who struck you in the head just before Sinner was taken. I told the man not to kill you, only to daze you. He did well. The slave shall be crucified for betraying his master, I said. The man is far from Rome by now, with a new name and a bag full of gold. We looked at each other for a long moment. At last, I broke the silence. Sinner made the Smyrna come true, using his own daughter. But you made his Orpheus and Pentheus come true. You tore a living man apart, you and your maenads, and then you burned the only copy of that poem on his funeral pyre. Poetic justice, Finder. We couldn't destroy all traces of his vile Smyrna. There are too many copies in too many hands. But we could see to it that Sinner's final dose of poison was never inflicted on the world. Poison? Caesar called it the crowning achievement of Latin literature. She spat on the floor. The judgment of men. Men who write poems about rape and incest to titillate other men, who declare such pornographic rubbish to be masterpieces. I heard enough of the Orpheus and Pentheus to know that it was another foul piece of garbage. Instead of a scheming nurse and a lust-mad daughter, the women were all mad, murdering monsters. But you became those monsters yourselves. She shook her head. That which is truly monstrous runs counter to divine will. Everything we did was pleasing to Father Liber. And now that you know the truth, Finder, let me caution you never to speak of it. I should hate for Sinner's terrible fate to befall a man of your quality. For the sake of your lovely wife and daughter, say nothing. We were both silent. I searched for the courage to ask a final question. Bethesda and Diana? Fulvia's smile was not unkind. That's the question you really came here to ask, isn't it? You'd figured out the rest already, or most of it, but you don't yet know if Bethesda and Diana took part. They both took part in the Liberalia, after all. She paused, seeming to enjoy the way I fidgeted as I waited for her answer. She drew a deep breath through her nostrils and narrowed her eyes. For better or worse, Senator Gordianus, your wife and daughter
played no part in sinners' punishment, nor did they have any knowledge of our plan. I excluded them intentionally, for fear they might give something away to you. Also, it's my understanding that once already, some years ago, they secretly brought justice to a man not unlike Sinner. No woman should be called on to do such a thing more than once. I had been holding my breath, braced to receive a different answer. My gasp was mingled with a sob of relief. "Now that you have the answer to that question, are we done?" said Fulvia. I shook my head. "Not quite. There's another reason I came here. There's something I have to tell you." She raised an eyebrow. "Sappho is dead." The sardonic smile vanished. "How do you know this?" "I came here from the house of Sinner. Polyxo found her this morning hanging by a rope." "I'm very sorry, Fulvia." At first she looked more shocked than grief-stricken. Then her wide eyes abruptly brimmed with tears. She said not another word, but turned and left the room. A little while later, Antony appeared, dressed now in his consul's toga. From his tone of voice, it was evident he hadn't seen his wife and her distress. "You still here, finder? Senator, I mean to say. I was just leaving. I'll walk you out." The house was noisier than before. As we drew near the vestibule, I heard many voices. "Another day, another meeting," Antony sighed. "What an awful lot of talk there's been since Caesar died." "Better talk than the alternative." "Perhaps. There'll be plenty of time for bloodshed later. I'll say farewell to you here before we reach the vestibule. I'm not quite ready to face all that jabbering. By the way, do you know what's become of my wife?" "She left me rather abruptly. I don't know where she went. Perhaps to the house of Sinner?" "Ah, to comfort Sappho, that poor girl. We're her guardians now, you know. I call her poor, but Sinner left her an enormous fortune, which it is now my duty to administer. Well, I shall leave the financial dealings to Fulvia. She's quite good at that sort of thing." "She's a most unusual woman, your wife." Antony smiled. "You don't know the half of it." Chapter 52. Consul's wife, a cannibal, and all those respectable matrons at the funeral as well. "Perhaps I've not become as Roman as I thought," said my Egyptian wife, tilting an eyebrow. We sat in the garden at midday, picking at a meal for which none of us except Davis had much appetite. In spite of Fulvia's warning to say nothing, which I took quite seriously, especially since her husband might eventually take Caesar's place, I knew it would be useless to try to keep the truth from my wife and daughter. I told Bethesda and Diana everything. Their surprise, it seemed entirely genuine, reassured me that Fulvia had been truthful when she told me they had no involvement in the plot. My relief was somewhat lessened by what Diana said next. "I wonder why Fulvia didn't ask us to take part, Mother. I thought Fulvia liked us."
"Would you have done so?" I started to say, but thought better of it. I might not like the answer. "Now, Fulvia was afraid one of you might give away the plot to me. I might have alerted Sinner, you see, or done something else to wreck their scheme."
"Ah, that explains it," said Diana. "Though I would never have betrayed Fulvia's trust, not even to—"
"Enough, daughter," said Bethesda, who saw the look on my face.
"What's done is done. Fulvia's friendship is genuine. If she excluded us, she was only doing what she deemed wisest."
Now we shall see if you can keep a secret from Fulvia, I said. She mustn't know I've told you.
I suspect that Fulvia will never ask, and we will never tell, said Bethesda.
Nor shall I, mumbled Davis, with a bit of flatbread stuffing his mouth. All the secrets one must live with these days, I muttered. The world will think that Sinner's murder was an unfortunate case of mistaken identity, and never know the truth of who killed him or why.
Would you have it otherwise, Papa? If people knew how he came to die, they'd also know what he did to suffer. Fulvia at least allowed him to keep his reputation as a poet intact.
Even as she oversaw the burning of his final masterpiece.
He insisted on living the Smyrna, said Bethesda. Fulvia saw to it that he experienced the Orpheus and Pentheus as well.
Her matter-of-fact tone made me shiver. So the world will remember him for the Smyrna only, and for dying a stupid, meaningless death, I said, and people will think Sappho was a dutiful daughter who killed herself from grief, not guilt.
I'm sure she felt both, said Diana quietly.
So you think Fulvia was right about the incest? Asked Bethesda. I doubted it at first. I didn't want to believe it. But Cinna's own written words confirmed it. Fulvia acted righteously, or at least believes she did.
I'm not completely sure that avenging Sappho was her only motive, said Diana.
What else? I asked.
Cinna was quite wealthy, was he not? With Sappho dead and no close relatives to make a claim, who's likely to get his hands on the entire fortune now?
I blinked. Antony. But surely you don't think Fulvia kills Cinna to get hold of his estate?
Fulvia has a great deal of experience at building a fortune through inheritance, noted Diana. And she'll always need more and more money if her ambitions for Antony are to be realized. Knowing that Antony would become Sappho's guardian on Cinna's death, and being well versed in the legal means by which a guardian might lay claim to an unmarried girl's estate, well, I won't say that's the only or even the main reason she plotted against Cinna. But things have worked out to Fulvia's advantage. Haven't they?
I shook my head. She couldn't have foreseen Sappho's suicide.
Even with Sappho alive, Antony and Fulvia would have controlled her inheritance, and could have scared off any suitors.
What a schemer you make her out to be! Next you'll be telling me that Fulvia had a hand in Caesar's assassination. Diana blinked and cocked her head.
That very odd idea came out of your mouth, Papa, not mine. But it would make sense. How else was Antony ever to fulfill the destiny Fulvia has in mind for him and become ruler of Rome? Caesar could only stand in his way.
Daughter, you're cynical beyond your years. But back to Cinna. Fulvia justified the killing as a pious act. You suggest she was driven by self-interest.
Perhaps, Papa. Like many powerful men in Rome, Fulvia is motivated by both virtues and vices. So mixed together it's impossible to sort them out.
I shivered, despite the warm sunlight.
But, Papa, today's your birthday, said Diana, clapping her hands. No more talk of death and deceit and other people's drama. You must do something special.
Yes, husband. You must do something to celebrate, said my wife.
Something out of the ordinary.
Davis nodded enthusiastically. I took a deep breath. Yes, I've been thinking about that. Today, I believe I will do something special, something unusual, something I haven't done before, anyway. And so I shall, after a long midday nap. Which surely I deserve on my 66th birthday.
Bring me a sleeping couch and a coverlet, and Bast the cat. Coda. Are you well rested, Papa?
Yes, Diana. That little nap cleared the cobwebs from my head.
Little nap? You slept for hours. It's almost sundown.
I blame the purring of Bast the cat. It puts me in a trance. Yes, I'll probably be wide awake well into the night. We have plenty of oil for the lamps here in the library, don't we? I glanced around the little room that housed my small but precious collection of scrolls. Stacked on a high shelf was the newest edition, my copy of Sinner's Smyrna.
We can make the room as bright as daylight, if you wish.
You exaggerate. Even with twice as many lamps, this room would be no brighter than twilight. I find it difficult to read, let alone write, by such insufficient light. It's these old eyes of mine.
If you want to read something, let me do it for you. I love to read aloud.
Yes, and you have a most pleasant voice. But it's a bit of writing I intend to do.
Oh?
Yes. I shall mark this birthday by embarking on a project that's been in my mind for quite some time. Sinner encouraged the idea. Any time I shared with him some anecdote from my investigations for Cicero, or my dealings with Caesar, or my travels as a young man, he would say, "You really must write your memoirs some day." And I would roll my eyes and tell him that only politicians were vain enough to write down their life stories. And yet...
Yes, Papa?
Perhaps I do have a few stories that might entertain a handful of readers. I may have a worthwhile insight or two about the powerful men and women I've known. I might even dare to reveal a few dangerous secrets, especially now that so many of the people involved are dead and beyond caring.
That would be splendid, Papa.
You really think so? Of course, some of the most amazing things I've witnessed in my lifetime would be quite hard to capture in words.
Such as?
I'm thinking of your mother. Stories about lustful girls turning into trees are all very well, but the metamorphosis of a headstrong Egyptian slave girl into a haughty Roman matron, to chart that transformation would surely tax the skills of even the finest poet.
Such stories are seldom told.
All the more reason for me to do so.
You might even tell the story of Sinner's death, the true story.
I think not. For as long as either Fulvia or Antony is alive, or the witch Polyxo for that matter, that shall be a tale too dangerous to tell. I shivered. I felt that quicksilver sensation of already seen that I had recently discussed with Tyro, the mental phenomenon of re-experiencing an exact moment from the past. I was sure the Etruscans had a word for it, though I couldn't remember it.
What are you thinking, Papa?
Well, I was thinking of Cinna and Sappho, and I was reminded of my very first investigation for Cicero, involving the murder of Sextus Roscius and the secrets it revealed, some of those secrets strikingly similar to those surrounding Cinna, uncannily so. But the case of Sextus Roscius revealed other secrets too, not just about the crime, but about the whole rotten state of affairs in Rome under the dictator Sulla. The highest perpetrators were too powerful ever to be brought to justice, I sighed. And so it is with Fulvia. If Caesar were still alive, there might be some appeal to him, especially since Cinna was his friend. But with Caesar gone, Antony and Fulvia are far too powerful to cross. When it comes to meting out justice, not much has changed in my long lifetime. Well, I shall never conduct another such investigation.
I am truly retired from all that.
Never say never, Papa.
I shook my head. I'll leave that sort of thing to Eco now. And perhaps to you, Diana. Yes, to you and Davis. I know it's what you long to do, to follow in your father's footsteps. I've always opposed the idea. But why not? The fact that you're female shouldn't stop you. You have the brains. He has the brawn. But your dear father shall be retired, here only to give you advice. Perhaps I'll never leave this house.
Except to attend meetings of the Senate, of course.
Must I? I suppose I'll have to make an occasional appearance, if only for the sake of my progeny. Hopefully, Senator Gordianus won't get into as much trouble as did Gordianus the Finder. I think I shall spend as many hours as I can here in the library, and in the garden, when the weather permits, dictating my memoirs.
Dictating them to whom, Papa?
You put your finger on the problem. At present I own no slave suitable for such a task. I suppose I'll have to shop around to find a reasonably priced scribe who not only can spell, but can also keep his mouth shut. Perhaps Tyro can help me find such a slave.
But, Papa, why purchase a scribe when you have me?
You, Diana?
Why not me? I've learned Tyro's shorthand. I can write as fast as you can dictate. You know my spelling is excellent, better than yours, anyway. And I can also correct any grammatical errors you make, even as I'm writing.
Grammatical errors?
Diana winced. Papa, you may have learned your Greek from Antipater of Sidon, but your Latin, well, it's not the most elegant, is it? But never fear. I can fix that.
I raised an eyebrow. Perhaps I should ask Mito for an editorial polishing, or Tyro. But I'm sure they'll both be much too busy.
Why ask either of those two when you have me? My Latin is every bit as good as theirs.
I scoffed. No woman ever wrote a book, Diana.
What about Sappho of Lesbos?
A handful of poems, quite famous, to be sure, the exception that proves the rule. No woman ever wrote a history or a memoir.
Or at least no woman ever got credit for doing so.
I looked at her steadily. You make the project sound like a collaboration. My memories, your deathless prose.
Deathless? You tease me, Papa, but why not? If you can tell an interesting story, and if I can add a bit of luster to the language, then who knows? Perhaps your memoirs will be read by your children's children, and by their children as well.
You forget that even the best books are terribly vulnerable. I saw a considerable portion of the library at Alexandria burned to ashes when Caesar was besieged in the royal palace.
And you were there with Caesar? And with Cleopatra, yes? That's just the sort of story you must include.
My point is about literary immortality. I know how easily mere parchment and papyrus fall prey to fire and water and mould, war and the whims of thoughtless men, not to mention hungry insects. The prose may be immortal, but the papyrus is not. Look at what happened to Cinna's final masterpiece, now gone forever. I shook my head. Who knows what documents will be lost to future generations? Can you imagine a world without Sulla's blood-drenched memoirs, or Caesar's brilliant war diaries? Who knows? Perhaps all that survives the ravages of time will be scroll upon scroll of those long-winded speeches of Cicero's, lovingly transcribed by Tyro, and ours will be known as the age of Cicero, seen through his eyes alone.
Or perhaps only your memoirs will survive, Papa.
and this will be the age of Gordianus.
I laughed.
Stranger things have happened, Papa.
I can't think of one. Or perhaps I can. There was that time in Babylon.
No, Papa, don't speak. Hold that thought. Let me call for a slave to light the lamps, and I'll collect a stylus and wax tablet, and we can begin.
Right here?
Right now? Yes.
I shut my eyes and allowed my thoughts to wander. After a little while, I perceived the lighting of the lamps through my closed eyelids. Perhaps, I thought, I should compose my memoirs in Greek. There was something to what Diana said, that my Greek was more formal than my street-learned Latin, having been taught to me by none other than Antipater of Sidon. Should I begin my memoirs with him, and with the voyage we took together to see the seven wonders? What remarkable things I saw! What unforgettable people I met on that trip! But no. It would be best to begin not at the very beginning, but somewhere in the middle of the action, as the Greek playwrights do. Perhaps with the day Tyro first came to my house, and I met Cicero, a turning point in both our careers, and perhaps in the history of the Republic. When I opened my eyes, Diana sat before me, a stylus in her hand, her eager eyes flashing in the lamplight.
I'm ready when you are, Papa.
I took a deep breath and shivered. Again. I felt it, that prickling sensation for which I was sure the Etruscans had a word. Never mind that it eluded me. The slave who came to fetch me on that unseasonably warm spring morning was a young man, I said, as Diana wrote, hardly more than 20. Da Capo. The End. This is John Curlis. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Throne of Caesar by Stephen Saylor. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a recorded books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.